The time to talk.
Yeah.
This is the Real BS Show.
That's true.
Nice porch setting music there.
Yeah, it's nice and relaxing.
I'm kind of worn out. And, well, I cut a lot of wood, so.
Yeah. But that's kind of healthy, isn't it?
Well, they say it is, but when you're 71, it's a lot of work.
Right.
It's a wrong hobby to have when you're 71. It's a... But, hey, you're out in the woods and you just got chipmunks and birds and stuff to...
And vitamin D.
Deal with. Well, in the woods, not a lot. Well, it's getting that way now because the leaves are all disappearing.
Yeah.
Which is... it's beautiful out there, really.
Yeah.
The fall's beautiful. And the weather's been super nice. I mean, it's like 70 degrees every day almost.
Yeah. Nice relaxing weather.
Middle of October. What the heck?
And it's something refreshing about being in nature.
It's kind of nice, this global warming. I'm liking it. I don't know what they're squawking about, but
there's this interesting thing. They did a study on a bunch of kindergartners and found that if they go into nature at least once a month, they have less reckless behavior. They have less aggression. And there's something about nature when you're going out in the woods.
It's working on me.
Yeah, there you go.
My problem is I watch too many YouTube videos about the coming crisis of everything. I mean, Right. Everything. Bubble. Whew. Just, I don't know.
But out in the woods, you're out in the woods.
You get away from all that.
You're just hearing crickets chirping,
Yeah, all kinds of. It's a nice breeze is always a good thing. And I don't know. It's... keeps me off the streets at night, I get worn out and then I go to sleep real quick. I try to listen to a ball game or something and boom, I'm out.
Just also going for a walk. I've been doing that, trying to do that recently because it's not been raining. And that's been refreshing. Just getting out and walking around and, all the things you read on the news, all the trouble that you hear, it just washes away when I'm on a walk, and you're doing wood and stuff. You're like, cutting wood, being out there in nature. You're seeing deer all the time. You're seeing animals, they're just carrying on, aren't they?
Yeah, the deer are my friends. They really like me. They do. I don't know. I guess they know my smell or something. Plus, I feed them corn, so that helps.
Right. And you don't hunt them. You just, look.
No, they show up every day at 4 o'clock, 4 to 6, someplace in there. They show up and stand there and look at you, look in your window and say, come on, let's go. It's time to eat.
They're like a cat.
I try to take a picture of my wood yard for the website, and here come the deer. So I said, what the heck, we'll put them in the picture. So they're part of the latest picture I put out. Yeah. Got about, 35, 40 cords of wood stacked up, and which is quite a bit. And
you should throw your website name in there.
BillsFirewood.com. I don't want no more business. I got enough. Because every time I sell a cord of wood, I got to replace it,
Right.
For next year or the year after, and because you can't sell it right away. You cut it, split it, and stack it, and let it sit there for a year and a half.
Right.
That way it's nice and dry. Something that a lot of people don't realize, and a lot of people that sell wood don't care about. They just cut it, split it, and sell it. Boom.
Got to let it dry. And you test it with a meter, don't you?
Big time. Yeah. Oh, sure.
What's that kind of meter called? Is that like a...
Moisture meter.
There you go, moisture meter, yeah.
Yeah. It's a... It's a big difference. Big difference.
You went from working in foundries, being an electrical engineer and, other companies like maintenance and stuff. You did maintenance on machines.
I started out as a millwright.
Right.
Big company.
Then you got into the audio business doing sound for, you name it, big bands and events and
presidents.
and now.
What an eye opener that all was.
Ooh-wee. And now you're like. You're like man in the woods.
Just get me out of here, Just keep me away from people.
and
I was mayor of Union City.
That's right.
You
were.
Remember that? A joke that was. Jeez.
You did good.
Well, yeah, but it was just a nonstop battle. Butt-kissing contest of major proportions, except for I didn't kiss butt, so then...
Right.
they tossed me out after one term.
I think you did great, though. In that term, you did more. You guided the town in the right direction.
Well, we got a nice super highway coming from Manly Heights down to the post office. So that was that was a biggie right there. And it didn't cost any homeowners anything. So, plus it probably saved some people's lives because they were out walking on the street.
Whew. Right.
And falling down on those old busted up sidewalks. And
you also had the town, you helped the town when the tornado hit.
I was out riding around on the backhoe over there trying to clear the branches and electric wires.
But,
what a mess.
But those were times that were good, you know, like in our town, you know, compared to, you know, what people.
Oh, you know, remember when we painted the town?
Yeah.
That was a biggie.
That was a big deal, yeah.
I didn't see any other politics in there at all. No. There was no councilman, no nothing.
No.
No city officials whatsoever.
You and I were on a scissor lift for that one.
Yeah, we were up there scraping, and I think all I did was scrape.
Yeah.
Scrape the old paint off.
Right.
The flaky stuff and other
people were painting. Yeah,
I remember that one lady. She was telling me what to do. I said, "Hey, I'll tell you what. Let's trade places. You crawl up here on this scaffolding, and I'll point at the spots you missed." It was hot too.
Yeah,
I remember that.
I never remember that. Yeah,
but that was like a weekend of scraping and painting, and I never seen anything like that before, ever. And I bet there was $200,000. Makeover there,
right?
All that paint and everything donated, and wow, that was. And I had nothing to do with it except for I joined in and
being a volunteer. Yeah,
yeah, just like one of the crew. So I did do an interview on TV. All I just brought up was that it's not costing any taxpayers, not even a nickel.
Right.
This whole thing. And I says, you show me another town that's doing this.
Right.
So,
and that paint's still standing in
David
a lot of those
Belmondo
buildings.
Didn't know what to say.
No, he didn't.
That was something. But, hey, it was an eye-opener, and it was, you know, I got to hang out with governors and senators and congressmen. And you remember when that one congressman came to town during the tornado?
Yeah.
And you called me from the fire department, and he said, hey, Mike Kelly's up here. He wants to talk with you. He wants to chit-chat. I said, tell him I'm eating my pizza down at the VFW. I said, I ain't got time. I said, you take him. You just find a camera crew somewhere, and that's all he's looking for.
Well, you know what I did? This is actually kind of funny that you bring this up. I took him on South Ave, and that's where the heart of it was, where the damage was. And I think most of the people down there must have been drunk or something, because they were climbing branches and they're acting drunk. I could smell beer on quite a few people down there. And so I said, hey, everybody, Mike Kelly's here. He's your congressman. And they all swarmed him, and I scooted out of there and left him there.
You don't know what happened to him.
No, I don't know. You know, right now he's under an investigation for some fraud.
Really?
Potential, yeah. So I
now you know he's a real politician.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. 100,000.
You know, that mayor thing was, people would ask me, say, well, how much does that pay? I says, well, I only get paid $100 a month, but I said, but it's all you can steal.
Yeah. You know? But, you know,
you got to be a good liar, number one. Yeah. And you got to be willing to steal.
Yeah.
Then you're a politician. You're perfect for the job.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't have nothing personal against Mike Kelly, you know. I just left him there because I just thought, hey, he's got this, you know. He
just rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah, he kind of burned me on the
showboat or something.
The U.S. Patriot Act when he reauthorized it. I kind of was pissed off.
He told me for
that.
6 months that he wasn't going to do that. Yeah. And as soon as he got elected, boom, he voted for it.
Yeah, I remember that.
He was like, you dirtbag.
He claimed he was against it. I remember meeting him and talking. He was talking about that.
I got it in writing.
Yeah. Yeah, he said that he was against reauthorizing the U.S. Patriot Act, and then all of a sudden he gets in there and reauthorizes.
Yeah, it wasn't a month or two later, boom, he voted for it. Jeez.
So, one of the things
you what you want to hear when you're standing in front of you, and that's it.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's really rough because that one is the one bill that, you know, we need to get rid of because it's giving too much privacy away and freedoms. Our Fourth Amendment's been eroded because of it. And I think it's time, in due time, that we get rid of it now. But
well, it's too late now. It's
embedded.
Freedoms are gone. Boom. You know, it's mandates now.
So on the note of that, I think we have a little segment here talking about the crisis with
which one? There's 100 of them.
So I think it's kind of, we just maybe prelude a little bit with it and just kind of talk a little bit about it, but leave most of it for this little segment. It's a very short segment, but there's so much more that could be talked about it. You know, there's so much criticism.
Well, I haven't heard this, so this is going to be news to me.
Yeah, there's so much criticism towards boys and men. I think it needs a little bit more nuanced discussion. And honestly, I think it's due time that we also talk about that, you know?
Would you say boys to men?
Boys and men.
Oh, and men.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a guy, you're bad, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
You're part of the problem. You're the problem causer.
Right. So, all right, well, let's play this and we'll come back.
Okay.
More men have died from suicide in the UK in the past year than all British soldiers fighting in all wars since 1945. A UK study found that boys' IQs have dropped about 15 points since the 1980s. Why? Well, one reason is less time spent with fathers. In my country, the UK, one in three children grow up without a dad. That's also true for the US. What links suicide, IQ decline, and fatherlessness is the key question, and that is it now objectively worse to be born a boy than a girl? That might sound like a controversial thesis, but I think it's one that we should certainly entertain. It will highlight some of the mind-blowing research compiled by Warren Farrell and John Gray in their book, The Boy Crisis. We're going to talk about men's mental, physical, and economic health, their education, and global patterns. And you probably won't believe some of these facts, but they're all referenced, they're all linked in the description down below if you want to check them out. Let's first stick with the theme of male health. When the evolutionary biologist Randolph Ness looked at the results of a 20-country study of premature deaths among men, he concluded being male is now the single largest demographic factor for early death. If you could make male mortality rates the same as female rates, you would do more good than curing cancer. Now, suicide is one of the biggest contributors to that life expectancy gap. Here are the facts. Suicide now takes more lives than war, murder, and natural disasters combined, stealing more than 36 million years of healthy life around the world. In many countries, the rate of increase in suicides is growing much faster for men than for women. For example, the rate of increase in male suicide in India is growing at more than 9 times that of female suicide. That's 37% versus 4%. Since 2000. More US veterans commit suicide each year than were killed in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even that staggering number is probably a vast underestimation of the true suicide rate, because many of those men choose to make their death look like an accident so that life insurance policy pays out for their family members. The National Academy of Sciences reports that the increase in suicide among white American males led to as many white males' lives lost to suicide as have been lost to AIDS. African American men, by contrast, stick with murdering and being murdered. Thus, while only 6% of the overall population, black males make up 43% of murder victims. More American black boys between 10 and 20 are killed by homicide than by the next 9 leading causes of death combined. Suicide increases as the pressures of the male role and hormones increase. Before puberty, the suicide rates among males and females are about equal. Here is what happens after that time. You see, by the time we get to the 20 to 24 range, the rate of male suicide is between 5 and 6 times that of females. 3 out of 4 women say that they would not date an unemployed man, and a man who is unemployed is twice as likely to commit suicide as an employed man. And speaking of employment, I want to read you one of my favourite segments from The Boy Crisis. Most of us take for granted how the home we live in was created at the risk of the lives of young men. For example, the wood in your garden likely began its journey with young lumberjacks risking their lives as loggers. The trees they felled were then hauled by long-distance truckers, another hazardous profession, to a site near to what would become your home. On their way, the truckers repeatedly stopped for fuel extracted by other men who had risked their lives on oil rigs, as in Deepwater Horizon. And the wood was ultimately used by construction workers and roofers, who, in the United States, die at the rate of one per working hour. Next, we need to talk about education. Boys scored lower than girls in the 63 largest developed nations in which the PISA, a set of international standardized tests, was given. As Warren Farrell writes, developed nations each have unique colloquial terms to describe their boy crisis. In China, they say yin sheng yang shui, which means the female, yin, is on the way up, while the male, yang, is on the way down. A gender stock market. In Japan, they use the derisive expression soshuko danshi, herbivores, and hikikomori, socially isolated, to describe the new generation of boys. In European countries, the acronym NEET describes young men who are not in education, employment, or training. Worldwide, boys are 50% more likely than girls to fail to meet basic proficiency in any of the three core subjects of reading, maths, and science. Among these core subjects, the UN finds that reading is the skill that best predicts future success worldwide. And what subject do you think boys are doing the worst at? Yes, it's reading. In the US, at the college level, men have gone from 61% of college degree recipients to around 39%. Young women from around 39% to around 61%. The number of boys who said that they didn't like school has increased by 71% since 1980. Boys are also expelled from school three times as often as girls. What's more, boys who perform equally as well as girls on reading, math, and science tests are graded less favourably by their teachers. Interestingly, the boys who behaved in the classroom in ways that the study identified as more associated with girls, for example by being attentive and eager, did receive grades equal to girls who scored equally in standardised tests. So boys may feel that teachers are discriminating against their typical boy-style behaviour, which, understandably, would then lead them to like school less. It's also important to note that grades translate into expectations about one's future, and boys' lower expectations can translate into depression, one of the major symptoms of which is obesity. Around a quarter of Australian, British, Canadian, German, Polish, and Spanish boys and men are now obese. Now, I could obviously keep going, but I'll just leave you with one more. If you want evidence that the way we've been raising boys in the last half century is leading to a deterioration in their mental health, you won't find a better US statistic than the 700% rise in the US prison population between 1973 and 2013. Of that population, 93% are male and are disproportionately young. Now, when we hear statistics like the ones in this video, we often think about the disproportionate number of, for example, black men in jail, or poor men's mental health, or young men dying in dangerous professions. But the lowest common denominator is always the noun, not the adjective. Men. Of course, the answer to the question that I posed at the beginning, whether boys or girls have it worse today, isn't necessarily that important in isolation. It clearly just offers a useful title and thumbnail to get you to watch the video. It's an entry wedge into a much needed discussion. If you want to hear more about this topic, including potential solutions, then check out The Boy Crisis.
Oh, the real BS show coming back at you. Now, Seth, you got to explain all that, what just happened there with... I'm not too bright.
Yeah, so...
Some guys are smart, some guys are stupid. Well, yeah. That's where I'm at.
So part of this is... there's some evolution going on with this, but Warren Farrell, not, you know, the comedian, the guy that wrote the book, The Boy Crisis, is outlining a lot of issues that boys are having nowadays. And we can't... You know, it's a tough topic for some people to talk about because they're pushing so much with girls having power with, like, STEM and, you know, promoting girls in, you know, other ways. And that's all fine and dandy. There's nothing wrong with promoting someone, but at the end of the day, there's also major issues with boys going on, and it needs to be talked about. It's not something that you can just blame on toxic masculinity. You can't just blame boys for being bad. There is some evolutionary differences between men and women, you know, and I think it's time that we look at it in a broader scope and recognize that boys do need help in some other ways. And it's, I think the main focus is,
well, they just need to come out and split wood with me. That's all.
Well, it's actually kind of funny you mentioned that. I think what's happening is a lot of the problem that boys are having, and men, 90% of people in prison have one thing in common, is most of them didn't have their fathers in their lives. And so you splitting wood with your, you know, child or
grandsons,
things like that, are promoting healthy behavior.
They, trust me, they'd rather be playing video games.
Oh, sure.
You know, the only thing that saving grace is I pay them.
Sure. But, you know, right now, that's something that's happening in Japan, in Europe, in the United States, is a lot of boys are escaping to video games because the problems in school. In school, they're told to sit down, shut up, and behave. Basically, they're trying to make the boys not have rough and tumble play. We kids, all kids, boys or girls, need rough and tumble play. Some need it more than others. And boys, on average, this is not a generalization when I say on average, I'm talking about studies have shown that on average, boys need more rough and tumble play than girls. And there's nothing wrong with that. And they're missing that. So they're being scrutinized for having boy behaviors in school. And they're being shunned for it. And on top of it, you factor in, they don't have role models sometimes. One third of kids are growing up without their fathers. So they don't have male role models of a, you know, healthy relationship. And it's starting to affect the boys.
Well, there's a lot of parents that aren't very good role models.
That's
too.
True. That's probably getting, another third. Who knows?
Yeah, that's but, getting big, but, too.
I would say most parents, though, are good parents. Not all of them, but most. And I think that needs to be respected. You know, yeah, everyone's, no one's perfect. But for the most part, most parents are doing a decent job of raising their kids. I don't think society's getting worse in how kids are behaving. They were saying that thousands of years ago, the Roman writers were talking about how horrible kids were acting. I just think this time, these times, kids are acting similar to who they were in the 60s in a lot of ways, even. Because you know why? Everyone's going to rebel against their parents. In the 60s, they did that with their parents. The baby boomers were rebelling against the silent generation. They were, you know, my parents rebelled against their parents. I'm sure you rebelled against your parents, you know, and, you know, I mean, these are things that every society goes through. But,
well, as a kid, you're so much smarter than your parents.
Yeah, everyone thinks that, yeah.
At least the kids think that way.
You know,
I thought that way too.
Yeah. I mean, as a parent myself, you know, I'm always trying to give my son some wisdom, and I tell it in stories. Because, like, as examples, like, oh, I remember one time when I was in the Army and this guy did this. And, you know, I tell those kind of stories as moral stories, like, don't lie, cheat, or steal. You know, those kind of things. There's a mentality. And here's the reason for them. But, you know, there's a problem, I think, you know, with the suicide rate. That, as the one guy from Ideas Sleep Fearlessly spoke about, that suicide rate with men is something that's disturbing. You know, I saw a poster one time where they were saying, there's one fourth of suicides are women. And I'm like, that's a crazy way of saying three fourths of suicides are men. You know, like, I'm not trying to say
slipping in the back door there.
I'm like, wait a second here. There's nothing wrong with saying that women are committing suicide too, but they're not at the rate that men are. And honestly, they're hiding the way they're doing it.
The military had that problem, too. I mean,
they still do. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We started the radio station because of that. Remember?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. There was 3 or 4 suicides in a matter of 4 months.
I know people that have lost kids to the suicide after they came back.
Yeah. Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
They came back with bronze stars because they killed so many people in these free fire zones and all this and that. And
right.
Ended up hanging in the basement.
I think that's the one major difference between World War I and Afghan and Iraq within World War II and World War I, there was an obvious front where the enemy was, and you knew the enemy was over here. And with Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq, you really didn't have an exact, throughout the whole war as a whole, you didn't know where the enemy was. The enemy could be anywhere. Like in Vietnam and Afghanistan, they were fighting a guerrilla war. And the psychological difference between the two is World War II, I'm sure there is people that had PTSD or shell shock from that war, but they knew where the enemy was. Whereas in Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq, you didn't know where the enemy was. And that's more traumatic. That's more scary. It's more dumbfounding how like neurotic that makes you feel when you don't know where the enemy is. Because they could just pop out of anywhere at any waking time.
So you just shoot anything that moves.
And that becomes, that does happen. But
I'll never forget when I went in the Army, first thing they said is, we're teaching you how to kill people. That's our job.
Yep.
That's all we're here for.
Every time we exercise, it's...
You make the other guy die for his country. Dying for your country is no big deal.
Right. Yep. So... Yeah,
kind of shocked me.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Every time we did exercising and we had to stand to attention, we had to yell kill. It was just driven into you. You know, when I was in the infantry, but the reality is the military is a part of it. We're also seeing suicide rates with young boys, even young as 8, committing suicide, and grades are falling really behind. 64% of college graduates are female and only 36 are male. That's a huge flip, Bill. That's a huge flip. Why is it so imbalanced now that there's less males going to college?
The guys are all becoming welders and house builders.
See, this is where I do promote the trades. The trades are a great thing. You know, I mean, we need to have trades. They say that more plumbers save lives than doctors. You know, I mean, we have to keep the trades, and the average age for trades is 55 years old. You know, they're getting older and starting to get ready to retire. And I think this is where I think boys do need to be lifted up, because they've been, you know, what's the common trope with boys or men is they're a bunch of loafs, dumb loafs, or they're quirky dorks. That's what the media puts out that boys are. And it's so disparaging and discriminating towards men that they're considered either dumb or dorks, yet women are propped up all the time. And I'm not saying that's wrong, you know, it's hey, whatever, but why is it men are dumb and dorky? You know, like that's like a pushback against a perceived thing that men were superior for the longest time.
Well,
you know,
that's the value of our media nowadays.
It's you know,
totally useless.
You know, I hate to say this, that men are not all Al from what's that one guy on TV? All in the Family, or not All in the Family. Al Bundy, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know him. He's my hero.
But, you know...
It's been a long time.
You know, if it wasn't for men, the society wouldn't be created. Think about all the trades. Why is it 99% of bricklayers are men? You know?
This is a tough job. That's right.
How about boiler makers? Why is it almost basically 100%? I don't think there's any females in that field. Any women. You know? There's no women in that field. Why? Why don't they want to go into that? That's a good paying job.
Foundries are kind of the same way.
Why are welders mostly men, too? Why don't women join in that? Or plumbers, electricians, or carpentry? They're starting to come into carpentry because it's, you know, it's a good paying job. But these are good paying jobs. But they're going for these social jobs. And I just think, you know, we need to have more people in trades. I don't care what gender they are. And so I'm the type, you know.
I'd rather do something useless like be a banker or something, you know. that doesn't produce anything.
You know, there's a theory that on average, again, we're not talking, it's not generalization. These are studies. Even in countries where they have the most equity, like Sweden, they have even more gender differences in what they choose. So more men in Sweden go to STEM. More women go into social work. And what the findings on these studies is called cross-cultural, meaning it's across many different cultures, that they are picking what they choose to like to do. And that's okay. You know, why would you want to force someone to go into STEM that doesn't want to go into STEM?
What's STEM?
Science, technology, engineering, and math.
Oh.
So.
It sounds boring.
Well, the findings is, on average, women prefer people things. And on average, men prefer things.
Yeah, like hydrogen operated cars.
There you go.
See? Remember that? Did that 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
It works. There's a solution there that probably everybody's overlooking. But I mean, you make hydrogen out of water.
You know.
So, it works much cleaner. There is no carbon.
You know.
It's so clean, and the engines love it. And it's just. But I think the oil companies put it down years ago.
Right. So, you know, the thing is with that is. The cars are starting to become more electrified. Let's say,
There's no combustion engine in an electric car.
No, it's very challenging though. You think about the batteries they have in that, and lithium is very dangerous.
Lithium. You know where lithium is? It's in Afghanistan. That's the world reserve right there.
Remember the show we did about the Bronze Age collapse?
Joe Biden just gave it away.
Remember the Bronze Age collapse episode we did?
Sort of.
Where did tin come from?
Probably Afghanistan.
Yes. So we're back to square one again.
Well,
getting our lithium.
If your son is in business with Chinese electrified companies, we just toss China some trillions of dollars worth of lithium.
They have opiates there too. They're growing poppies.
Yeah,
everywhere.
They like that too.
Protect those poppies, Taliban.
Well, Biden. What's his kid's name? He likes opiates.
Yeah, he does.
Opium.
Talking about tough people. You ever have to deal with someone that's really a rough person? Dangerous, rough person?
Oh, many times.
I can't mention.
Keep your mouth shut as best as possible.
I can't mention too much. I have a family member that's not directly related to me, but indirectly. And they're an alcoholic, and they're a very rough person. And you got to want to give away names, you know. And I this next segment here reminds me of this person. To a T. Very violent.
Oh, how to deal with a
violent,
a nasty person.
Yeah. Very, very violent. This person that I know is willing to fight in the moment if they think you're crossing them wrong. And... they're not dumb. That's the problem people think is a bunch of, when people are drug addicts or alcoholics, that they're dumb. And it's not the case. They're just addicted to something. And they can be very intelligent and very ruthless and lacking empathy, having no empathy. And there's people like, oh, they have to have some empathy. They have to care a little bit. No, there's some people out there that are born biologically without empathy, not caring about others.
Well, and when they're drunk.
And sober.
Alcohol, kind of.
And sober. That's the key here.
That's probably why I'm here. Budweiser.
Hey.
I don't know.
Alcohol's been around for a while. Even Jesus turned water into wine. So,
was a pusher.
So, in this next segment, I think it's some good advice.
Yeah, these are ones I haven't heard, so I'm going to be all ears.
It's good advice to handle, because we're talking about some issues that men are more violent than women on average.
Yeah.
And well, here's how you deal with them.
All right. Well, let's maybe we can educate a few folks.
Sure.
And believe me, man, I was thinking about what I was saying, because he was watching me, like a rough guy watches you. And a rough guy watches you like this. He thinks, if you say one thing that indicates contempt, you're going to bloody well pay for it. I've dealt with lots of strange people in my life. Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, and that isn't to say that everyone that I've dealt with was strange, because that's not the case. But I have encountered some very strange people, and, the way to deal with strange people is to, you never lie to a strange person. That's the thing. Especially if they're paranoid. You never lie to someone who's paranoid. It will come back to bite you. And if you're in an extreme situation with someone who's very unpredictable, the only thing you have that works is the truth. That works. I'll tell you a little story. This is in my book. So I had this landlord in Montreal. He lived next door to me. He was an ex-Hells Angels biker. He'd spent a lot of time in prison. And his wife had borderline personality disorder, and she committed suicide when I lived there. And he was a rough guy, and he was a Quebecois. He spoke Joual, which I could hardly understand. And he didn't really know what to make of me, and I didn't really know what to make of him. But we got along, you know, and I was very careful talking to him, as you might imagine. But my wife and I went over there, and we had spaghetti dinner one night, and we sort of communicated, and I bought a poster from him because he made these wooden posters that had neon on them, and that's how he made a living. He'd kind of trained himself to be a bit of an electronics guy, and so he made these things, and he was trying to quit drinking, and we talked about that. He was a lot older than me. He was like 20 years older than me. I was about 25 at this point. We got along pretty well, but every now and then he'd go out and drink, and he could really drink, you know, like he was one of these guys who could drink like 60 beer, and you think, well, no one can drink that much, and you're wrong. I studied alcohol for like 10 years. Some of my subjects' fathers drank 40 ounces of vodka a day and had been doing it for 20 years. So you can drink a lot, and he could drink a lot. And what would happen? He was trying to not drink, but he'd go out and go on a binge, and then he'd be gone for like 3 days. And he'd drink up all his money, and then we'd hear him out in the backyard howling at the moon with this little ugly dog he had, you know? And he'd howl, and the dog would howl, and he'd howl, and the dog would howl, and... And it was rather unsettling and made my wife nervous. And but worse, you know, now and then he'd come to the door at like 3 a.m, eh? And he'd knock on the door and he'd be standing there. And I don't know how much experience you've had with rough guys who are alcoholic and who are drunk, but they can be upright and unconscious at the same time. And so that was the state that he was in, you know. He'd be just swaying. And he'd ask me if I would like to buy his toaster or his microwave because he needed some money to keep drinking. And, you know, I didn't really want to buy his toaster or his microwave. But when the ex-Hells Angel, Joual-speaking, 60-beer-drunk Quebecois biker shows up at your door at 3 a.m, offers to sell you his microwave, the easiest thing is to say, I really need a microwave. So, you know, I bought the microwave and the toaster and some other things. But then my wife talked to me, and she liked my landlord, you know, even though she was afraid of him, she liked him. And she said, you can't buy any more appliances because it's not good for him. And I thought, that's an interesting problem. You know, so what the hell am I going to do about this? Because, no, I don't want to buy your microwave. Just doesn't seem to be the right answer at 3 a.m. So one time he took me out on his 750 Honda, and he put me on the back of it. He wanted to show me his lair, I guess, his hangouts. And I got his wife's helmet on, but it didn't fit. It just sit on the top of my head. And he said, I got on the bike and he said, if the cops chase us, we're not stopping. and then away we went. And we went to these like these bars downtown on Saint Laurent. They were very rough places. And he got into like 4 fights that night because he was a rough guy, you know, and these kind of punk guys would come up to him and sort of challenge him and act stupidly around him. And he was very skeptical. And if you were acting stupidly around him for any length of time, he'd just hit you because he felt that that's what you deserved. And perhaps he was right, you know. So I had first-hand opportunity to observe him. So anyways, he, sure enough, about a week or two after we had this conversation, he showed up at the door, knock, 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 you know. I opened the door, and he was standing there, you know, with his eyes kind of half-closed, and he was swaying, and he had, I don't remember what the appliance was this time, but he wanted to sell it to me. And I said, I'm not going to buy this, because I know you're trying to quit drinking. And if I give you this money, then you're going to go and drink it up. And it's not going to be good for you. And I think I told him as well that this whole thing of him coming to my house at like 2 a.m. was scaring my wife, who he liked, and that it had to stop. And believe me, man, I was thinking about what I was saying. Because he was watching me like a rough guy watches you. And a rough guy watches you like this. He thinks, if you say one thing that indicates contempt, you're going to bloody well pay for it. And so I was finding my words like, you know, I was crossing a swamp and trying to look for the rocks underneath the surface. And I said what I had to say very, very carefully. And he looked at me for about 15 seconds. And that's a long time to be looked at 3 a.m. And he left. And he never came back to sell me anything again. And we got along fine. But that's a good illustration of this issue with regards to truth and success in the strange land. Because I was in the strange land when I was talking to my neighbor, my landlord, then. And I managed to say what was true carefully enough, so despite the fact that he was a very violent person, and that he was a very intoxicated person, and that he had every reason to be suspicious of me, and we couldn't communicate very well, and I didn't do what he wanted, he took it, and he left, and there was no problem, and life went on just fine after that. And so we don't want to underestimate the utility of establishing this bounded relationship with the ideal and attempting to live with some nobility in truth while aiming at the highest ideal. There's nothing about that that's anything but strengthening and positive. And it's exactly what you need to set against the catastrophe and uncertainty of life.
It's a real BS show. Hope you got something from that.
Yeah.
I don't know, just carry a pistol around with you. That ought to influence a few people.
I think that would prevent a lot of deaths and murders and rapes if people were armed and dangerous and knew how to use the weapon.
Yeah. Except unless you're an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And then you can't have to mandate that, you know. No alcoholics carrying weapons.
Yeah, alcoholics have, if you go back to the prohibition, you know, why did that start? And that started because a bunch of teetotalers didn't like drunks how they were. And at the time, there was a lot of violence and crime because of alcoholism. And, you know, I have aunts and stuff, great aunts that are still alive today.
Well, then they made it better by outlawing alcohol.
Yeah.
And then Al Capone took over.
Yeah, and then the government poisoned the ethanol, or the methanol. Well, you know, they threw methanol in the ethanol, and because people were drinking the ethanol, around about that way. You know, they were basically poisoning alcoholics and killed like 20,000.
Took all the gold.
Yeah,
so, yeah. It's patriotic. Give us your gold.
Yeah.
As soon as he got it, boom, it went up $15.
We're still facing that today. You know, with financial issues and, you know.
Oh, man, that's probably my biggest YouTube adventure is listening to all these crazy things that are going on financially. And it's just beyond, like I say, what's the next step over a trillion? I think it's quadrillion.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we better get ready because you add all this debt up across the world, and we're going to start pushing quadrillion.
I think it's at 28.5.
Well, that's the United
trillion.
States.
Yeah, I know.
And well, then, it's in the trillions. It's like 150 trillion unfunded liability for Social Security.
Right.
So, I mean, that's something nobody's talking about, but
no.
It's there. I mean, that's what we owe.
Right.
You know, unless we get a COVID thing where everybody dies off, you know, old people.
Yeah.
That could save the day.
Yeah. They did that with nursing homes, you know. I mean, I'm starting to wonder if that was planned. It's not to be a conspiracy if they throw a bunch of COVID patients in nursing homes.
You got to be a governor to get away with that.
You know, real quick on that, you know, I'm not sure if we covered this already, but, you know, the CDC and the World Health Organization finally admitted that it's airborne. Not only droplets, that COVID is airborne.
Aerosol.
Airborne aerosol, same thing. And it's the 100 micron line. They used to say, if it's 5 microns and over, that means it's droplets. And if it's 5 microns and under, then it's aerosol. Well, guess what? They're wrong. If it's 100 microns and over, it's droplets. But if it's under 100 microns in size, that it's aerosol. So that means flu, measles, COVID, tuberculosis, all of that's airborne. And that means it spreads in the whole room. So this 6-foot thing, or 2 meters, is just a guidance. It's make people feel comfortable. But really is when you walk into a store, it's everywhere. It spreads that easily.
It takes a while to hit the floor, huh?
It's aerosol, so it's in your air floating around. And
kind of like a cloud.
Yeah. You know you know what the malaria means?
No.
It means bad air. And the Romans and the ancients knew about bad air. You air out those areas, it makes it cleaner, makes it safer. And we went away from the idea of bad air because we thought the science was bunk on that. They used to treat everything as bad air, so you had to clean out all the time. But you have to think about it. That's an observation. If people are dying and you clean out the air by opening the windows, then that's not, and people are no longer sick, then it's not a bad observation. It's still valid. But they found, this is the truth though, we need to air out our buildings, basically. And that will help with COVID drop magically, drastically, if we air out buildings. But financially, we've been really hit with the restrictions and the inflation going up, with the debt ceiling going up. They want to raise the debt ceiling, the deficit ceiling, I'm sorry. And, you know, the deficit is what? The yearly. It's yearly what they're...
Well, if they don't raise the debt ceiling, we can't pay our past debts.
Right.
Now, how stupid is that?
Yes.
And it's like one credit card paying off another credit card.
And, you know, they're just throwing it down the road for future generations. And there's people out there that promote that it's good to have this such
there's
a massive...
No, there's no plan whatsoever to get out of debt.
No. They believe
that... The
plan
is to how big we should get more into debt.
There's some people that are saying we need to have more debt, and that's scary.
Well, that's the Federal Reserve. They want inflation. They like inflation.
And... The sad thing is, you know, when they say 2% inflation, that's not true. It's not a 2% inflation every year. That is predicted back in when they took us off the gold standard, that 2% should be the perfect standard.
Well, that's how much gold they find, mine every year for a long time.
Right.
2%. So, I mean, they're figuring gold is money.
Right.
You know, and we add 2% more every year. That's their inflation rate.
But the reality is the inflation rate's higher than that, and it has been. And what's happening is...
We ain't seen nothing yet.
when you have inflation, it's hurting people with their money in stocks. It's hurting people with retirement plans. It's hurting those on Social Security. It's hurting the poor. That's something that a lot of these people that are pro-inflation and pro... fiat currency aren't realizing they're hurting the poor.
Well, it's a tax. It's just a tax.
It's a hidden tax, yeah.
Well, I ain't very hidden.
Well, most people don't care about
every
it.
Every week the gas goes up 10 cents.
Most people don't care about it, though. They think, oh, it's just, you know, it sucks that this little thing's going up or this is going up. But in the grand scheme of things, if they were to see everything condensed down from a 20-year period down to a single moment in a chart, you could see what is killing.
Back in the early 2000s, I was buying silver for $4, maybe $5 an ounce.
Right.
Now, silver's down, and it's $22 an ounce, $23 an ounce.
That's scary.
And it should be $50 or $100 an ounce, which is going to get there.
Yes.
It's headed that way. It's just, you know, buy right and sit tight. That's all.
If you look at gold, I think gold's a good predictor. If you look at it in the last 40 years... We'll make it even 50 years in the 70s. If you look at from 1970 to now, how much gold has basically gone up in price, it really hasn't. It's been stable.
Gold didn't go up in price. The dollar went down in value.
Yeah, exactly. Gold has been stable the whole time. It's the U.S. dollar is losing value, and it's drastic. Yeah. It's drastic.
Well, in 71, it was $35 an ounce, and now it's $1,800 an ounce.
Right
close to there, and it's been over that. It's been over 2,000, and it's going to go there again.
Right,
real soon. Ask China; they're hoarding it.
Yeah, why is China hoarding it?
Well, they know. They know what's coming.
So, do you want to talk about how America's standing?
Yeah, let's do a little something. A friend of mine, Mike Mahoney, did a well, I think he talked about the debt ceiling and
right.
You know how goofy it is, and let's give him a listen. He explains things pretty easy, so he,
right.
Most dummies like me can understand it. So let's let Mike take it away.
Oh my God, we've got to do something about the debt ceiling or we're all going to die. So, you know, this is another video on this dog and pony show that they do periodically about the debt ceiling, because it's not over with, folks. This is going to come back to haunt us in December again. So I'm going to change this around, and instead of reading it the way it's written, I'm going to say, what is the debt ceiling and why should you care about it? Because I wanted to turn it into a question, because the answer is simple. You shouldn't. Ignore this stuff. It's just a shell game, a stupid dog and pony show that they trot out every once in a while to try and distract you from what is really going on. Oh my gosh, we've got a pandemic. Don't look at that. We've got the debt ceiling. Governments have overreached all across the planet, and they're trying to control all of their ceilings. But don't look at that. We've got the debt ceiling. We just lost a war, and all of these very, very expensive weapons have fallen into the hands of our enemies. But don't look at that. We've got the debt ceiling. So let's take a closer look at this and see what's happened in the past. I want to read you something here. Mountain of Debt. On March 16, 2007, Congress passed a bill to increase the debt ceiling on the national debt from $8.2 trillion to $9 trillion. But as I'm writing this, just a few months later, the debt is already $8.98 trillion, and Congress has just approved the fifth increase on the debt ceiling in the last 6 years, raising it to $9.8 trillion. This $850 billion increase should last another few months, and it's entirely possible that the national debt could surpass $10 trillion by the end of 2008. Well, guess what? It was $10.7 trillion by the end of 2008. This means that a baby born in the U.S. as a U.S. citizen in 2007 comes into the world owing approximately $30,000. Well, that baby is now 14 years old now and owes about $90,000, and it still isn't of working age yet. If it finishes high school, it's got another 4 years to go, and this $90,000 will have probably doubled at the rate they're spending it these days, will have probably doubled by then. And if he or she goes to college and spends another 4 to 6 years in college, then you can double that figure again. So we're getting toward the end of this scenario that we're going through. What's all that from? It's from my book, Guide to Investing in Gold and Silver, which is very pertinent today. If you haven't downloaded this yet for free and read it, please do so. I want to give this to you as a gift. I predicted quite a few things in here, and about 70% of them, 60 to 70% of them, have already come true. The rest have yet to come true, but I do believe that all of it will come true. So, the debt ceiling, an explainer by the White House. So this is from the White House's website, and there are many different types of treasury debt. And it says ranging from a few days to a few years, all the different notes, bills, and bonds. And the United States has not run an annual surplus since 2001. I debunked this in a previous video. My definition of surplus or deficit is how much did we owe at the beginning of the year, how much do we owe at the end of the year, and if we owe less, there was a surplus. If we owe more, there was a deficit. This is very simple accounting. A child can do this, but not the U.S. government. And so in 2001, we ended the year owing $18 billion more than we started the year. So what is the debt limit? The debt limit is a ceiling imposed by Congress on the amount of debt the U.S. federal government can have outstanding. This is important because this is a lie. It's a limit on the amount of debt that the government can have outstanding. That would mean at any moment. This limit has been set at $28.4 trillion since August 1st of 2021. So this is less than 75 days ago. Now, the president wants to point out here that Congress and that prior years, by prior Congresses and administrations, in fact, they've spent 97%
of the current national debt items. So that's what we're paying for. But that's since January of 2021. So we've had a little over 9 months of spending that totals 3%. It's already over 3%. By the end of the year, it'll be like 4 or 5% of the national debt. And that's every year. And, you know, this is just since January of 2021. Now, we're going to go to another one of these releases by the White House where we're going to contradict what we have just said. So remember that, going back to this one, that it's a limit on the amount of debt that the U.S. federal government can have outstanding. So here, the president wants to thank all of these people and organizations for joining me today to talk about the need to raise the debt limit. We haven't failed to do that since our inception as a country. We need to act. These leaders know the need to act. What? The United States pays its bill. It's who we are. It's who we've been. It's who we're going to continue to be, God willing. That's what's called the full faith and credit of the United States. Let's be clear. Raising the debt limit is paying our old debts. It has nothing to do with new spending or what may be coming this year or other years. It has nothing to do with my plans on infrastructure or building back better, both of which are paid for, but they're not even in the queue right now. So they're paid for. I mean, he put on a suit jacket that he hasn't worn in a couple of years, reached in the pocket and goes, oh, I found an extra $3.5 trillion. And by the way, that's a smoke and mirrors. If you look at the bill, they moved around a bunch of stuff, and it's actually going to cost more than $5.5 trillion. So they were able to hide $2 trillion of this spending. And it is so magnanimous of them to be able to just spend all of this on us to save us always from certain death if they didn't spend all of this on us. But how do they pay for this? They borrow by issuing bonds that we end up paying for in taxes. So it's just a closed loop. They're charging it. They've got this credit card. The credit card supposedly has a limit, that is the debt ceiling, and they're charging it up. But who pays the credit card? We do in the future. So here's Yellen warning of a catastrophe if Congress doesn't handle the debt ceiling issue. And it says that the Senate approved a short-term extension of the debt ceiling, but it's going to be back to haunt us in December. So just expect another bunch of this distraction and just ignore it. This keeps on happening over and over again like a bad nightmare that you can't wake up from. So here's the debt ceiling, how it got to $28.4 trillion. Now remember, this is a ceiling that they're not supposed to be able to spend beyond. And they used to raise the debt ceiling, and then they would spend and spend and spend until they hit the debt ceiling, and then they'd start screaming and trying to scare us, and they'd raise it again, and they kept on spending and spending and spending, and they keep on raising it and spending and spending and spending. And then they raised it, and they kept on spending, but then they came up with this new trick. They suspend the debt ceiling. Now remember, debt is not something that goes up. This is a pit. You have to fill this with currency later. They're digging a pit in front of us. So it's really a debt floor, a fictitious floor, because that floor has a trap door in it, and they open that trap door at any time by suspending the debt ceiling. And now they raise the debt ceiling to whatever they have spent in the past. So here back in, I think that was 2019, they raised it up to $22 trillion, and then they suspended it, and they kept on spending and spending and spending, and they spent $6.4 trillion more than the debt ceiling. So you just saw the White House contradict themselves with their statement on what the debt ceiling is and how it works. Well, how it works, this is our level of prosperity that's determined by the goods and services that we all create for one another. It's the economy. And here we have the past, the present, and the future, and we're all sitting in this little digger here, and time never stops. This digger is moving forward at a constant rate. It cannot be stopped. And what we do is we go out into the future and we dig these pits. We dig a little bit of a pit with a 30-year bond, a 20-year bond, a 10-year, 7-year, 5-year, these are notes now, and then we get down to bills. And we dig these up, but remember, this never stops. So before we fall into this pit, we have to dig up some dirt and keep on piling it on top here so that we raise up the pit that's in front of us until it gets to at least level. But preferably what they do every year is they borrow more, leaving a much, much bigger pit out in front of us. And so to whom do we owe this huge pit? Well, let's take a look at this. So you go to fred.stlouisfred.org/categories. There's all these categories you can look at, and I encourage everybody to do this. We've got federal government debt. Now, a few days ago, it said there were 6+ charts in here. Now it says there's 10+. So you click on this, and you discover there's 39 charts in here. So yes, I will agree with the Federal Reserve that 39 is more than 10. At least they've got that right. So we take a look at all of these charts, and we have, you know, there's the federal debt here. But there's different categories of debt. So some of the breakdowns, there's 22 1/3 trillion of federal debt held by the public. Now, the public breaks down into categories as well. So here we have private investors is 17 trillion. And here we have federal debt held by foreign and international investors at 7.2 trillion, which, by the way, if you divide this by GDP, is about 1/3 of the U.S. economy. So if you took the entire U.S. economy, you'd have to go for 4 months of that economy to pay back foreigners that have loaned currency back to us. And then there's the federal debt held by agencies and trusts. I always find this to be a crack-up because agencies and trusts, what are trusts? Well, the biggest one is the Social Security Trust Fund. It's a trust fund. You have to try. This is supposed to be like a savings account. They take this from you in taxes out of your paycheck. They force you to turn cash over to them. And this is going in your savings account. It's a trust fund. Trust us. We're good for it. And then they borrow against it. This is the amount of U.S. treasuries that is held by these agencies and trusts. So, almost 6.2 trillion are the IOUs that are left in your savings account for Social Security. They borrow the cash out of there, they add it to the general fund, and they spend it. And so these are some of the U.S. treasuries that are issued end up in our Social Security Trust Fund, the IOUs that you're going to retire on. How do we pay those IOUs? You do, through future taxes. I think it's just absolutely hilarious, this game that they're able to pull on everybody. And it's so complex that it gets everybody's head spinning and they just sort of lose track of it and go along with it. And it's a shame because we are getting fleeced, basically. Federal debt held by the Federal Reserve. So how much of the federal debt do we owe the Federal Reserve that got to type currency into existence, counterfeit currency into existence, and buy the IOUs from the Treasury that we work in the future to pay taxes, to pay the principal and the interest on these bonds, bills, and notes back. And it's 5.6, I'm going to round, 5.65 trillion. And so we keep on going here. And so this is the whole enchilada. This is the enchilada with sauce and cheese on top. The whole enchilada is 28.529. Wait a minute. That's more than 28.4. Remember that the total debt outstanding can only be 28.4, but we're at 28.529 already, and that was established 75 days ago. So this is the federal government current tax receipts. So this is the income that they charge us to pay the 28.529 trillion. And now to close this, I'm going to read a little bit more. This is talking about the crisis that will happen. There's going to be a crisis someday. And so I wrote about this back in 2007. Investors may, in the short term, run where they've been taught to run for safety and buy U.S. bonds in a kind of knee-jerk reaction. But think about it this way. Would you loan a guy your life savings and take his IOU, knowing that the guy is promising a rate of interest that's half the real rate of inflation. That's what's happening now. It wasn't that way back when I wrote this, but that is what's happening now. That he has been borrowing from everybody in town for more than 70 years. Well, this was 14 years ago, so you got to add, you know, 84 years. And that he has spent far more than he has borrowed for a majority of those years. I suspect not. You wouldn't loan it to him, right? In this case, that guy is our very own government, and the last time it paid back more than it borrowed was 47 years ago. Now you got to add 14 to that, so it's 61 years ago. It already owes more than five times its annual income. Well, if you take what we owe today, the whole enchilada, and you divide that by the current tax receipts, you come up with, instead of five times when I wrote this, it's now almost 14 times the current tax receipts. And that's since, you know, this was written just before the crisis of 2008. It's very pertinent today. I want to give you a free copy of this book, and it's really worth reading because you will see the changes that have happened in the meantime, the stuff that is yet to come, and the stuff that has come to pass. So it owes 14 times its annual income through tax revenues. It's promised everybody in town that it will deliver goods and services to them that will cost more than 20 times its annual income. I didn't do this, the math on this yet, but what I'm talking about here is the unfunded liabilities. So that kid that was a kid born today owes about $90,000 to pay for what has already been spent. And so that is what the president was talking about. It's the debt ceiling is about being able to pay what we've already borrowed and spent, what's already owed. It has nothing to do with, and that's true because they can just open up this trap door in the fictitious floor in the debt pit that we keep on digging for ourselves. It's going to end badly for everybody except precious metals investors and potentially cryptocurrency investors and a few others. So protect yourself and good luck. I hope you got something from this presentation. I'm Mike Maloney.
And this is The Real BS Show. Hey, you know, there's one more guy I'd like to everybody to hear. He woke me up back in 2006, 2007, someplace in there, right. Maybe 2008, when he was running for president.
Right.
And everything he said was brand new to me. I didn't realize, I didn't even understand what he was saying, but the fractional reserve banking and about gold, right. how we were all living on fiat currency. I mean, it's just paper, you know, really. There's nothing backing it, which has been that way since 71. But
right.
He's the first guy that woke me up to that and how all this blowback from all the crazy nonsense that we've been doing all around the world, we like causing our own problems by getting into everybody else's problems. I think we should leave everybody with a bit of him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this, what you have is probably 10 years, 11, 12 years old.
Right.
But yeah. Back then, it was just as sound and sensible as it is now. I mean, even more now, because now you can see what's going on. And
I would say a lot of the things that he has said now is
way ahead of his time. Yeah.
For me, I was kind of the canary in the mine for me was the U.S. Patriot Act. And I remember reading it when I was in the military. And then I remember Bill Barr running for Libertarian, and I remember voting for him in 2004, I think it was. I might be wrong on that. And then Ron Paul ran in 2008, correct?
Right.
Yeah. And I remember, like,
I worked hard for him. I really did. I did everything possible, sine ways.
What he was doing was something very unique. And he spoke, I think, where the Republican Party should have went, and they should have listened to him.
Well, all he did is make fun of him.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody made fun of him. Giuliani, the media, they just made it just a joke.
They did not like what he had to say about the Federal Reserve or anything about the military. You know, he was not anti-military. There's a reason why many people in the military, like me, liked Ron Paul.
Yeah, he had more donations and votes from the military than anybody did.
And it wasn't that he was anti-military at all. He was pro us getting out of these wars that dragged us out for too long.
Yeah, keep us from being a policeman of the world.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes. And also, you know, he had a lot of great views about how the government should be ran, a small government. And
everything effective. He predicted and said is coming true.
Yeah.
And it's still going on, yeah. And we ain't learned a lesson at all.
The main complaint people had about him is, you know, he was trying to explain things out, and he was best in long-form talk, where you just could talk freely like we are now. We're not scripted. But when you put him in front of the news cycle, where you have a 30-second soundbite, he couldn't condense it down because, you know why? It's hard to condense things down.
Well,
like this.
The news media tries to trick you up every last. It's like you're on trial or something.
But you can't explain complex things in 30 seconds. It needs long form discussion. And our predecessors in the politics, if you go back to Lincoln or other politicians or Teddy Roosevelt, they didn't have 30-second sound bites. They explained things in long form, what their views were. And we need to get back to that. We really do. I think the 30-second sound bites of these politicians talking is killing our politics. You know?
Well, you got CNN.
Yeah.
And MSNBC, I guess.
Yeah.
And then now we got Bolshevik Biden in the White House and his crew.
Yes.
I mean, what a bunch of idiots.
You know,
I've never seen anything. I've never ever believed this could happen. And they say he won the election. I don't believe it, but there he is.
You know, we can include something after the Ron Paul thing. We'll believe it as a surprise.
Okay. All right, because it's a surprise to me.
Yeah.
All right, let's listen to Ron Paul.
Republican Congressman and two-time presidential candidate Ron Paul wants to audit the Federal Reserve, arguing that Americans need to know more about the central bank, especially given the dramatic increases in the size of the bank's balance sheet. He spoke at the Cato Institute June 24, 2009. The full event is available at cato.org.
It's a real delight to be here, and of course, I'm pleased to come here and discuss a subject that fascinates me and has been an interest of mine for not a couple years, but quite a few decades. Matter of fact, it was the monetary issue that first got me interested in running for Congress back in the 70s. And some of you here may even remember the 70s, and they were rather hectic. If you don't remember them, you probably have read about them, and they were very hectic. And I was fascinated with the fact that the Austrian free market economists predicted early on in the 60s that the Bretton Woods arrangement would never last, and it failed. And then that led into chaos of the 70s. But on a lark, I thought I would speak out and run for Congress. And there was a little bit of concern by my wife about this because she considered it a dangerous thing to do. And I couldn't understand that. And to her, the danger was that I could end up getting elected. But I guaranteed her that couldn't happen because I was going to be talking about, the Federal Reserve and the Federal Open Market Committee and who cared about that. But she was more right than I was on that. But the 70s were hectic, and there was a cry even at that time to know more about the Federal Reserve. And even that decade was not the first time the people, through their congressmen, were speaking out and wanted more openness about what the Federal Reserve was doing. Early on, even from 1913 on, there was always somebody talking about it. And interestingly enough, a lot of that sentiment originated in Texas. Anybody remember Wright Patman? He came from a populist viewpoint. He wanted to know more about how Wall Street was being taken care of by the Federal Reserve, and he wanted the books open. And lo and behold, Henry Gonzalez advocated the same thing. But they came not from a free market perspective, but a populist perspective. But at least they were advocating more openness. In 1978, there was a change in the law. It was a law that we're dealing with today. And the law said that the Federal Reserve now can be audited. And you think, well, that's fine and dandy. But Interestingly enough, and this is not unusual for Congress, they said, sure, you can be audited except for A, B, C, and D. And, of course, A, B, C, and D are all the important things that the Federal Reserve does, whether it has to do with FOMC meetings, whether it has to do with international agreements, deals that they make with other central banks, the international financial organizations, all that is to be kept secret. And so it was more or less exempt from freedom of information, access to Freedom of Information Act, and therefore, really, we don't know a whole lot about what goes on behind the scenes at the Federal Reserve. But conditions have changed dramatically, if you haven't noticed, in this past year. And although I've been talking about it for decades and arguing that we had a financial system that was very friable, very vulnerable, and it was the Fed that was creating the bubble. And therefore, we should be looking into it and preventing these problems rather than waiting for a cataclysmic financial crisis to hit. But and there were more than a few talking about that. But nevertheless, Congress and others were receiving too much benefit by a secretive Federal Reserve system that created money out of thin air and was able to finance big government. So there were two groups over in the Hill that loved this setup. The one group, the conservatives, they loved it because you could finance war without being responsible. And the left liked it because you could finance welfare without direct taxation. It was the indirect taxation through inflation, the looting of the money supply that financed big government. And the question, the best answer I have about defending my bill is asking a question. Why not? I mean, why in the world should this much power be given to a Federal Reserve that has the authority to create $1 trillion secretly, and Congress says nothing? I mean, why not? I mean, it just means that it just makes so much sense. So the sentiment has changed. It wasn't because all of a sudden the people woke up and decided the Federal Reserve indeed needed to be audited and we needed to know more about the Federal Reserve. It had to do with the TARP funds. It was $700 billion. It's sort of like what they do after the emergency, like 9/11. Well, we need a Patriot Act. If you don't vote for the Patriot Act, you're not patriotic. And they rush that through in a couple weeks and nobody gets to read it, but the people want action. So when the crisis hit, TARP funds were passed, $700 billion. There's still a bunch of it floating around, but all of a sudden, some of those funds got into the hands of unsavory characters, like people who ruined their companies, and they ended up getting hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in bonuses coming from the American taxpayer. People say, what is going on? And they send a strong message out to Congress. We want to know what's happening. We want transparency. Let's find out what's happening. But then it became known to so many people at the grassroots level that the Federal Reserve is very much involved. They don't quite understand how the Federal Reserve created our problems, but they understand how the Federal Reserve has been very much involved. So though I have a different motivation for transparency overall because of the monetary system and what's been going on for years, right now the motivation is to know what kind of shenanigans the Federal Reserve has been up to and how they've been wheeling and dealing and bailing out their friends. Congress deals in hundreds of billions of dollars. The Federal Reserve deals in trillions. And it is we don't know exactly how much line of credit guarantees and direct loans that they have made and promised. And its estimate could be $3 or $4 trillion in the past year. But we don't know exactly. So the real necessity is for us to find out. And then we deal with the aftermath. The bill is mainly to open up the books and find out what's going on. It does not deal with monetary policy. It does not deal with regulatory policy. And it's mainly for opening up the books. So it's less confrontational for those who want to design regulations and deal with monetary policy. And I think that's why we're getting such bipartisan support. The support is very strong, but it is a reflection not of my ability to go around and twist arms, because I have no clout whatsoever over in the Congress. But there are a few spammers out there that are interested in what I've been doing, and they're letting their congressmen know. For that reason, there's a strong move on, and there's a lot of legislative consequences going on where this goes and when we have hearings and whether it gets added on in the Senate. And I don't think we have enough time to go into all those details. But one thing for sure is it's never going to be the same again. Never. Because if tomorrow, if they come in and all the members of Congress, or they remove their names and it changes and there's no transparency, all we have to say is, what do they have to hide? And for once, I think it's the first time the Federal Reserve has hired a lobbyist to lobby members of Congress against this bill. And guess where the lobbyist came from? Well, she's a hangover from Enron. She lobbied for Enron. So that's very appropriate. She'll know the ropes, and she'll recognize a Ponzi scheme and hopefully. But unfortunately, she'll probably be wanting to protect it. Anyway, we are very pleased with it, and the thrust of the bill is just openness to find out what's going on. And of course, my ultimate goal will be that once you find out exactly what the Federal Reserve has been up to, and the conclusion being that it's the Federal Reserve that creates financial bubbles, and of course, Congress adds a lot of problems to that, but that's the key to it. And once that is known, and once you see the deterioration of the dollar, which will come, you can't double the money supply in 6 months and not have some consequences to it. That is when we will have true monetary reform, and that's when we'll have a lot more fun.
Ron Paul represents the 14th Congressional District of Texas. You can watch his full comments on Federal Reserve transparency at cato.org.
Oh, this is the real BS show. Yeah. Jeez, I fell asleep. Before we say goodnight, let's do a little quickie here at the end.
Yes.
Now, this is Kamala Harris and Joe Biden.
And Joe Biden, yeah.
Before the election.
Yes.
Talking about the vaccine.
Yes.
Now, you listen to this, and then you compare that to what's going on now.
I have to say, I'm vaccinated, and, you know, when I found this, I was like, wow, I forgot all about this. But I remember it when it was played. I know them saying this, but anyhow, yeah.
Okay, so let's say goodnight, and check this out.
So let's just say there's a vaccine that is approved and even distributed before the election. Would you get it?
Well, I think that's going to be an issue for all of us.
If and when the vaccine comes, and it's not likely to go through all the tests that needs to be and the trials that are needed to be done.
When we finally do, God willing, get a vaccine, who's going to take the shot? Who's going to take the shot? You can be the first one to say, put me, sign me up. They now say it's okay.
And the question of whether it's real when it's there, that requires enormous transparency. You got to make all of it available to other experts across the nation so they can look and see. So there's consensus, this is a safe vaccine.
If the president announced tomorrow we have a vaccine, would you take it? Only if it was completely transparent that other experts in the country could look at it. Only if we knew all of what went into it.
If Donald Trump can't give answers and the administration can't give answers to these three questions, the American people should not have confidence.
But if Donald Trump tells us that we should take it, I'm not taking it.